This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من ذا الذي عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S. military launches airstrikes in eastern Syria. The Pentagon says the attack was carried out at President Biden's direction. Washington says it will recalibrate relations with Riyadh as it prepares to release an intelligence report on the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Also ahead, the UK policing watchdog says British police are disproportionately using stop-and-search powers against black and other ethnic minority groups. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, the U.S. says it has launched airstrikes on a number of facilities in eastern Syria. Washington claims the facilities were being used for rocket attacks against American troops in Iraq.
We're confident in the target that we went after. We know what we hit. And we're confident that target was being used by the same Shia militia that conducted the strikes. And so you'll get more information.
The Pentagon said the attack was carried out at President Joe Biden's direction. It said multiple buildings were destroyed as a result. A UK-based war monitor says the attack killed 17 fighters. US forces have been targeted in Iraq recently. On February 15, rockets hit an airbase in Erbil Airport, killing a non-American contractor. A number of U.S. contractors and a service member also sustained injuries. Iraqi resistance groups condemned the attack. They had also denounced a December attack on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad's Green Zone. In October, the groups reached a conditional ceasefire with American forces present in Iraq. Rick Sterling is from the Syria Solidarity Movement and joins us now. Rick, welcome. This comes on the backdrop of the attack on U.S. military base in Erbil Airport with rockets. From a military perspective, many will be asking right now, how can Iraqi resistance forces attack Erbil Airport in northern Iraq or even Baghdad's Green Zone with rockets, which don't have accuracy and very limited range, all the way from Syria, another country?
Yeah, well, clearly that attack did not come from Syria, so it's a clear violation of international law that the United States is attacking the sovereign country of Syria. So in the past, under President Donald Trump, he did that twice, and the pretext at that time was the claim that chemical weapons had been used. And now we've got Joe Biden attacking Syria, claiming that he knows that people are responsible in Syria for an attack on a U.S. military base in Iraq. So it's twisted logic.
Right, but that's what Washington is claiming. But if you can just help us expand your thoughts on this one, the latest attack on Erbil Airport, or even the targeting of the U.S. embassy in Baghdad's Green Zone have been met with condemnation by Iraqi resistance factions, including the group Washington says it attacked today, Qataif Hezbollah, because there is a ceasefire with the U.S. occupation forces. So any group targeting airports or the U.S. embassy or any other diplomatic missions are going against the wishes of the Iraqi resistance. And then secondly, the majority of these operations that we're seeing in Iraq, Iraqi civilians are being killed. So who is conducting these attacks at this particular time? Who benefits? And we know Erbil, the Kurdish semi-autonomous region, there are Israeli agents operating there.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good question, because in the past there have been some people call them false flag operations. Basically, events are manufactured to give a pretext for escalating conflict or for making some political moves. So what you're saying about the Iraqi resistance forces being, you know, denouncing these attacks, points to that possibility taking place. I think the larger context is that over a year ago, the Iraqi parliament decided and basically passed a resolution that the United States troops should leave Iraq. And that's the larger context in which the U.S. forces are supposed to leave there. And clearly, Washington does not want to pull them out. They're looking for justification to stay there. And we've seen the rise in the last couple of months. We've seen the rise of terrorist activities from ISIS in Syria as well. And that's another area where what you were suggesting earlier, the U.S. has exploited ISIS at times for its own ends.
Yeah, Rick, it's a very fishy situation. Something smells off here, because we had a similar sequence of events last year, and I'll just point them out. You had the K1 military base in Kirkuk that was attacked. An investigation was conducted, no conclusion. The Iraqi Prime Minister says there was no Iraqi resistance forces active in Kirkuk at the time. The U.S. attacks the PMU, just like today, on the Iraqi-Syrian border, killing dozens. You had a funeral procession that went across the Green Zone, a demonstration outside the U.S. embassy, and the U.S. assassinates Iraqi commander Haj Qasem Soleimani and the commander of the PMU. Until today, nobody knows who targeted the K1. The investigation found that it wasn't the Iraqi resistance. So I'm just thinking, is there another pretext here at this particular time?
Well, it's definitely possible. One interesting element is that the information that you're saying right now is not in the Western media. This is information that's being kept from the United States public. And meanwhile, I wanted to just to highlight the doublespeak that comes out of Washington. They're claiming the attacks, and I'm going to quote, the attacks in Syria that they've waged in the last 12 hours were an operation to protect American and coalition personnel, and that it aims to de-escalate the overall situation in eastern Syria and Iraq. So they're claiming that attacking, launching missile attacks in Syria is supposedly that's de-escalation. So it's a twisted logic.
That's a bit funny, because there are no American troops being killed at the moment. The only people that are being killed from these operations are Iraqi civilians. Rick, thank you very much indeed. Rick Sterling from the Syria Solidarity Movement joining us out of California. Now, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called for sanctions against Iran. Netanyahu said only military threats and tough sanctions will slow or prevent Tehran from attaining a nuclear weapon. Israel has been pushing for international pressure on Iran over its nuclear program for years now. That comes as Israel itself is known to have hundreds of nuclear warheads. Iran's nuclear program has been subjected to one of the most intensive inspections ever in the world. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has also issued a fatwa. It bans the production, possession, and stockpiling of nuclear war weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. The United States has announced its bid to rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council and seek an election for its panel for the 2022-2024 term. Washington's return to the Geneva-based council is aimed at eliminating the focus on its ally Israel. But doesn't this draw the immediate conclusion that Israel is guilty of breaking international law, especially in the occupied territories, that it needs U.S. shielding?
The Israeli regime is infamous for breaking a long list of international laws, which has drawn worldwide condemnation. Back in 2020, the United Nations General Assembly condemned Israel the most, as it adopted 17 resolutions against Tel Aviv's violation of international laws. That's almost three times more compared with the rest of the world combined, standing at six. The Gaza Strip has been subjected to the longest blockade in modern history. In 2007, Israel imposed a land, sea, and air blockade on Gaza. The inhumane blockade severely restricts imports and exports, people's movements in and out of Gaza, and access to agricultural land and fishing waters, denying Palestinians of their basic human rights. All of these actions are against international law. Israel also demolishes the homes of Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem outlets and elsewhere in the West Bank in order to provide land for building illegal settlements. According to the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334, settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem outlets are a flagrant violation under international law. Adding to that, Israel frequently targets military positions inside the war-hit Syria, hitting more than 500 spots in the year 2020. Moreover, Israeli aircrafts repeatedly violate Lebanon's airspace on a daily basis, which, again, is a clear violation of international law, in this case, Lebanon's sovereignty. The regime is also the only possessor of nuclear warheads in the region. However, it has always refused to accept or deny having nuclear weapons. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency, as it has never allowed inspections of its nuclear facilities and has refrained from joining the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Recently, reports revealed that Tel Aviv was expanding its Dimona nuclear facility, which provides the regime with material needed for its nuclear arsenal. The regime is estimated to have between 100 to 400 atomic warheads. That is why Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program. Meanwhile, it has carried out several assassination operations against Iranian nuclear scientists over the past decade, all in defiance of international law.
Well, we don't really need the U.S. Claims to... for us to believe that Israel is breaking international law. It's been doing that ever since it claimed independence 70 years, more than 70 years ago. And it's the worst offender. There's no question that Israel, it's an occupying, it occupies, terrorizes 70 years. No other country, you can think of Myanmar, it was very bad with its Muslims, but not even one-tenth of what Israel does really every day.
Washington's latest bid for the UN Human Rights Council comes 3 years after former President Donald Trump left the body and now claims to place human rights at the heart of its decision. Ironically, it has also said that Israel, a human rights violator, is targeted unfairly at the council and needs to be protected. Tel Aviv's crimes have drawn stronger international condemnation, especially from the UN. However, Washington accused the rights body of displaying hostility towards Israel. How can the U.S. use the human rights card against other countries, yet protect one of the worst human rights violators, namely Israel?
Three years after former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration withdrew from the United Nations Human Rights Council, his successor Joe Biden has moved to rejoin the panel for the 2022-24 term. Washington walked away from the council during Trump's term in office in 2018, accusing it of displaying hostility toward Israel. That is why Washington's bid to rejoin the Geneva-based rights body is aimed at eliminating the so-called unfair focus on Israel. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has been widely condemned internationally for its violation of international laws. The occupying regime is routinely on the UN General Assembly's agenda since late 2006 and is condemned for violations, as mentioned, in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Previously, Biden stated his opposition to the expansion of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He also said the only way to reach peace between Palestine and Israel is a two-state solution. However, his administration's move to shield Israel against international outcry over its crimes somehow contradicts his earlier remarks about Palestine-Israel issue.
Of course, it undermining the UN. The UN's very weak anyway. It's got really no political clout because it's still ruled by the veto in the Security Council, and any reasonable requests laws are vetoed. So it doesn't really have any clout now. But it does have these committees, and it does get some kind of press coverage, and it has credibility. People don't see the UN as an evil force.
The Israeli regime's malicious acts are not hidden from the eyes of international human rights bodies. However, Washington's attempt does not only seem unfair, but also undermines the UN Rights Council's credibility. When Israel holds the record for the most broken UN resolutions, the credibility of the UN as a rights body comes into question.
The White House says it will recalibrate relations with Riyadh as the U.S. prepares to release an intelligence report on the gruesome murder of Saudi journalist Jabal al-Khashoggi.
As you know, we've committed to the release of an unclassified report that would come out from DNI and not from the White House. And, of course, our administration is focused on recalibrating the relationship, as we've talked about in here previously. And certainly there are areas where we will express concerns and leave open the option of accountability. There are also areas where we will continue to work with Saudi Arabia, given the threats they face in the region.
Saki told the reporters that Washington is considering a range of actions on the table regarding Saudi Arabia in response to the investigation. U.S. President Joe Biden spoke with Saudi Arabia's King Salman by phone on Thursday. According to the White House, Biden stressed the importance of human rights and vowed to make the relationship between the two countries more transparent. The U.S. intelligence report is expected to be released soon. It will reportedly single out the kingdom's powerful crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, the king's son, for approving Khashoggi's death. The U.S. State Department said the findings will be a step towards ensuring accountability.
I know as an American.
This relationship, to be sure, is multifaceted, but we want to ensure that we bring those facets much closer in line with our interests and our values. And this is an important part of that, this being the release of that report, and the accountability that will ensue.
Price said the release of the report is an important step in the direction of transparency, stressing that Biden will review the entire U.S.-Saudi Arabia relationship. Saudi insider-turned-dissident Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside the country's consulate in Istanbul in 2018. The CIA has directly linked bin Salman to the murder. Saudi Arabia's de facto leader has denied any involvement. Riyadh says Khashoggi's murder was a result of a rogue operation. Saudi Arabia enjoyed cozy ties with former U.S. President Donald Trump, who blocked the release of the report. A British government watchdog says the police are disproportionately using their stop-and-search powers against blacks and other ethnic minorities. The governmental organization, tasked with inspection of British police forces, said blacks, Asians, and other minority groups are four times more likely than whites to be stopped and searched. It noted that unless a reason was provided for such an imbalance, the police risk losing the trust of the communities. The UK government has defended the measures taken by the law enforcement, calling them necessary and potentially life-saving. This is while human rights groups say the unnecessary use of such powers exacerbates racial tensions in the country. The European Union has declared Venezuela's ambassador to the bloc persona non grata after Caracas ordered the EU envoy to leave. A statement said the member states had agreed on the move, which was proposed by EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell. This came after Caracas on Wednesday gave the bloc's ambassador 72 hours to leave the country following EU's decision to sanction 19 Venezuelan officials. The EU described Caracas' move as wholly unwarranted and contrary to the bloc's objective of developing relations and building partnerships in third countries. The West expanded its sanctions against the Latin American nation following the December legislative elections, claiming the vote was rigged. Venezuela, however, rejects the allegation as baseless. Brad brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
the limelight.
Speaking during an appearance on conservative radio host Dana program, Ted Cruz, who had left Texas with his family to travel to Cancun, Mexico, as millions of residents suffered extreme temperatures without heat, electricity, and running water in the wake of a brutal winter storm, said that the media's coverage of his travels were unfair. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker, news writer. This article is published under the heading, "Unrepentant about his Cancun trip, Ted Cruz blames media for publicizing it." Here's more. After attempting to do significant public relations damage control over his jaunt to Mexico, while Texas was in a deep crisis caused by Winter Storm Uri, Senator Ted Cruz is now trying to suggest he is being victimized by the media. Speaking during an appearance on conservative radio host Dana program recently, Cruz, who had left the state with his family to travel to Cancun, Mexico, as millions of residents suffered extreme temperatures without heat, electricity, and running water in the wake of a brutal winter storm, said that the media's coverage of his travels were unfair. He also said he believed the media was looking for a new Republican politician to belittle. The media is suffering from acute Trump withdrawal, where for 4 years every day they could foam at the mouth and be obsessed with former President Donald Trump, Cruz said on the program. And now that he has receded from their day-to-day storyline, they don't know what to do with themselves. The Texas senator made similar complaints on Sean Hannity's Fox News program later that evening. The media is suffering from Trump withdrawal, where they have attacked Trump every day for 4 years. They don't know what to do, so they obsess over my taking my girls to the beach, Cruz said recently. Cruz's exploits were indeed widely covered in the media, but it's questionable whether that was a result of the media not having a subject like Trump to cover, as he suggested. Rather, articles detailing Cruz's travels recently focused on his departure from a state that saw millions without power after an unusual winter storm system caused damage to Texas' electrical grid, which was not equipped to handle severe cold weather events the same day the other two federally regulated grids in the U.S. are. Several U.S. officials in Texas have wrongly blamed renewable energy sources for playing a role in the state's power woes. However, several fact-checking organizations have shown that those types of energy sources weren't to blame for what happened, and that they work well in other, typically colder environments. Many news organizations also noted the inherent hypocrisy in Cruz's flight to Cancun, Mexico, as Cruz himself has criticized other politicians on multiple occasions in the past for traveling when a crisis was underway. As Cruz was going back and forth between Texas and Cancun, at least 7 million residents of his state were under boil water advisories. food shortages were also prevalent throughout several areas, and at least 32 Texans have died as a result of the crisis overall. Although Ted Cruz had intended to stay in Cancun, Mexico with his family through Saturday, after initial backlash over his holiday on social media, he booked a flight back to the U.S. immediately after landing. In a statement he released recently, justifying why he felt it was appropriate to leave while millions of his constituents were suffering without power, water, and food, Cruz blamed his daughters. He said, "With school canceled for the week, our girls asked to take a trip with friends, and I wanted to be a father for them."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
When the U.S. says Iran, Israel jumps and shouts, "Nuclear program." Well, if you still haven't noticed that this is just a performance Israel uses to cover up its own secret stockpile of nuclear warheads, come along, let me tell you the story of a not-so-secret actual nuclear facility in our region that even the U.S. is not allowed to visit despite its generous aid funds to the host entity. The UK's Guardian newspaper reported last week that Israel's top secret nuclear research facility near the southern city of Dimona is undergoing a major expansion, claiming the construction work is visible in satellite imagery published by an independent expert group. But wait, hold on a second. That's the same Israel that has worked day and night to sanction Iran and even pushed to start a war with Iran under the pretext that the latter had a secret nuclear program, although Iran allows regular inspector visits from the IAEA? Yes, that same Israel. You see, Israel started the construction work at the Dimona site sometimes in early 1958, but it took the United States intelligence community almost 3 long years to discover the site for what it was, namely a nuclear site under construction. In early December 1960, the CIA distributed its findings to the other government agencies, including the White House, State Department, and Congress. Et voila, Dimona was revealed. For decades, the world has known that the massive Israeli facility near Dimona in the occupied Naqab Desert was the key to its secret nuclear project. Yet for decades, the world and Israel knew that Israel had once misleadingly referred to it as a textile factory. Since the early 60s, world leaders knew that the Israelis were seeking an eventual nuclear weapons capability. However, not once did they see it as a threat to strategic stability in the Middle East and a nuclear proliferation threat the way they wail about Iran's non-existent one. It's a particularly fascinating story set against the backdrop of the modern-day international negotiations over Iran's unproven nuclear program, while Israel continues to pursue a policy of ambiguity of how much it has upped its stockpile of nuclear warheads since the program started back in the 50s. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Israel's top-secret nuclear research facility near the southern city of Dimona is undergoing a major expansion. To this day, Israel has never acknowledged that it has a nuclear arsenal, instead maintaining a policy of nuclear ambiguity, while Western governments have played along with the policy of opacity by avoiding all mention of the issue. To discuss this issue with us from the city of Cork in Ireland is Gregory Casey, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Gregory. Now, in an extraordinary feat of subterfuge, we have Israel managing to assemble an entire underground nuclear arsenal, now estimated at 200 warheads on par with India and Pakistan, and even tested a bomb almost half a century ago with a minimum of international outcry or even much public awareness of what it is doing. What gives Israel the right to do so?
Well, in my humble opinion, Israel has no right whatsoever to do this. This has been ongoing since the late 1950s, 1960s, when the French secretly gave the Israelis the nuclear technology to enable them to build a nuclear missile. There have been varying estimates as to the amount of missiles that are in place in the facility, ranging from 200 to 400. With all due respect to the Israelis and to everybody else, all it takes is one nuclear warhead to flatten half the Middle East. You don't need 200 of them or 400 of them. But what's even more frustrating is that the IAEA, I was looking last night at some pictures of a representative of the IAEA congratulating himself on coming to an agreement with Iran for continuing inspections of the Iran's peaceful nuclear facilities, while at the same time the IAEA has simply no interest whatsoever in establishing what's on site in Israel, how many warheads they have, or having Israel come into compliance with the IAEA. Mm-hmm. The hypocrisy on the part of the IAEA by the European Union, specifically in my instance, because I'm a European citizen, is staggering.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gregory, Dimona, which is widely believed to be key to Israel's nuclear arms manufacturing program, was built back in the 50s with covert assistance, as you mentioned, by the French government. And it was activated sometime between 1962 and 1964. Yet the U.S. was kept in the dark for some years, and it was disappointed when Israel actually kept the site a secret one. How would a nuclear program like that of Israel actually affect the U.S.'s influence in a region like West Asia?
To be perfectly honest, given the history of the Israeli presence in West Asia, if we go back to 1973, it is now established from, you know, the opening up of the archives of the U.S. State Department, amongst others, that in 1973, the Israelis threatened to explode a nuclear bomb in the Sinai as a warning to the Egyptians. Apparently, they were persuaded that it was not necessary for them to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But the threat was made. Now, as I said earlier, how many bombs does it take to detonate in the Middle East to flatten the entire place from the Hindu Kush to the Mediterranean? To be perfectly honest, I mean, you mentioned 200 earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
I think most independent commentators now maintain that there are, in fact, up to 400 missiles.
Well, that's the interesting part here, Gregory, because the issue is, if actually Israel chooses to use any of its warheads, it will for sure risk its own security inside the occupied Palestinian territories, hence causing a disaster against its own colonial settlers and against the Palestinians, the Jordanians, the Lebanese, the Egyptians, and the Syrians as well as the Mediterranean Sea. I mean, what exactly is the point of stockpiling such number and amount of weapons of mass destruction in such a place?
Well, either it stems from a great insecurity, or it is essentially a form of warmongering.
Mm-hmm.
And look at me, see how powerful I am, how dare you challenge me. The fact of the matter is that regardless of what US interests might be in the Middle East, when you break it down, ultimately, Israel will do what's in Israel's interests. It will follow its own. It will follow its own line. The head of the armed forces of Israel, together with Bibi, I think 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, made crystal clear that they were very much against the U.S. return to the nuclear agreement with Iran, that as far as they were concerned, it made no difference because one way or the other, as far as they were concerned, Iran is a malign influence in the Middle East. The fact of the matter is the malign influence in the Middle East is not Iran, it's Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And having a stockpile of 400 nuclear missiles sitting in the Negev that hang essentially over the people of the Middle East in perpetuity is simply outrageous. I mean, you know, America in 2015 under Obama set aside a program of $1 trillion for quote-unquote renewal of its nuclear arsenal over the following 10 years up to 2025. What nobody has been able to establish is how much of that money, of that $1 trillion, has been set aside in support of the Israeli nuclear arsenal at a time when, you know, the great game between the USSR, Soviet Union, America, and, you know, Europe in the middle is long since over. It's 30 years. 32 years since that came to a finish. I really have to ask, and any reasonable person would have to ask, why in the name of God does Israel require 400 nuclear missiles? It does not.
Well, Gregory, we did hear Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif lashing out at European leaders and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, for turning a blind eye to Israel's quiet expansion of the Dimona nuclear power plant, or nuclear plant, actually, it's not a power plant, it's a nuclear facility for warheads in the occupied Naqab desert, while targeting Tehran's nuclear program, which is a peaceful one. Do you think that will affect the JCPOA in any way?
Well, I certainly think in the context, I was listening to, I think his name is Tevridis, this morning on MSNBC, NBC,
mm-hmm.
Saying that, you know, America should return to the IAEA to the JCPOA with Iran,
mm-hmm.
but it would be conditional and that they would require Iran to do far more. Because the term of that agreement has almost expired. I think it will expire in next year or the following year.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's crickets, complete silence on the fact that Israel has these warheads. As I said earlier, if it had one, that would be bad enough. Mm-hmm. If it has 200, I mean, you
exactly.
know,
exactly. This is where I want to get up, where we will have
risk.
You back again, Gregory Casey from Cork, Ireland, a political commentator, to talk more about this matter. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for this segment. I want to thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We will continue talking about this matter from our next guest from inside Palestine.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Israel is considered to be the fifth nuclear power in the world. In addition to owning nuclear bombs that can be dropped from the air, its nuclear arsenal includes also nuclear warheads that can reach a distance of 1,500 kilometers using the Israeli-made Jericho missiles. Estimations show that Israel is in possession of at least 200 nuclear bombs, but other sources indicate that Israel actually owns massive quantities of uranium and plutonium that enables it to produce an additional 100 bombs. Dimona, a mystery threatening West Asia, in this following report.
The Israeli nuclear reactor of Dimona is vulnerable to meltdown, like the Russian reactor of Chernobyl almost four decades ago, which caused a humanitarian and ecological catastrophe. According to experts, if Dimona melts down, it would affect an area 500 aerial kilometers in radius, reaching Cyprus and the entire neighboring region. A study conducted by the Jordanian authorities back in the early 2000s after a request from the Palestinian Environment Quality Authority revealed that the Israelis are aware of the possibility of a meltdown in Dimona reactor, which in turn would affect the whole region, mainly the Jordanian southern city of Tafila. The study also showed that radioactive substances are leaking from the Dimona reactor in a way that has increased rates of cancer diseases among nearby population, particularly those of Tafila city. The location of Dimona's reactor in the Naqab Desert is a delicate one, situated between Egypt, Jordan, and the Palestinian-occupied territories. The reactor was built in the 50s as part of a deal with France, who pledged to build the reactor in exchange for helping it and the United Kingdom in attacking Egypt in what was known as the 1956 Tripartite. As for funding the reactor's driving material, the United States later took care of that, in addition to giving assistance with moving quantities of enriched uranium to Israel. The area on which the Dimona reactor is built on includes nine buildings, including the reactor building itself. Each building is tasked with producing a certain type of materials used to produce weapons of mass destruction, such as plutonium, lithium, and beryllium, used to manufacture nuclear bombs, in addition to producing radioactive uranium and trinium. The Dimona reactor is considered to be the most mysterious secrets of the nuclear world, as Israel categorically refused since its occupation began in 1948 and after building the reactor any routine inspection that other reactors around the world goes through. Israel is the only entity that opposes the inspection visits conducted by the International Atomic Energy Agency IAEA all over the world, added to its rejection until this very day to sign the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, which was signed by all surrounding Arab states.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Ramallah is Dr. Nimr Saad, academic at Bir Zayed University. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Saad. Now, back in 2003, there was a study that was published at request by the Palestinian Ministry of Environment Quality from the Jordanian authorities, which revealed high cancer rates were recorded in all the southern Jordanian governorates, which confirmed the possible direction of nuclear dust that might be leaking from Dimona.
This also confirms that Palestinian villages in and around the occupied Naqab area are all contaminated. How is that not the top priority for international human rights bodies?
As a matter of fact, yes, the ammonia reactor is becoming now a hazard, a big hazard in the southern part of Palestine. Not only that it affects the Palestinian villages and the Bedouin who are living in the Negev Desert, and also the other parts of the West Bank, which is closer to a certain degree near Hebron, to this nuclear reactor, and also the Jordanian area. So it's not the leaking or the contamination that we have been noticing recently, and it's the numbers of Bedouin communities in the Negev Desert who had cancer in a higher rate than usual. It's because of this reactor. So the whole idea is that not only that the Palestinian asked the Jordanian to do this kind of research on the ammonia reactor, but the problem is that it has become very old, and apparently there isn't a good maintenance during that period, which might get that reactor to melt down or to explode in a way or another. And the Israelis, they don't care, especially that there is no international monitoring for their Dimona reactor. Because of that, it became really a big hazard and a big problem and issue today.
Well, it was revealed throughout the years that many Israeli colonial settlers lost their own family members who worked inside the Dimona reactor, and they filed charges against the Israeli government and against the management administration of the reactors, demanding compensation for the cancer that killed their own members of the family who worked inside the reactor and were exposed to radiation. Do such cases have maybe enough drive inside the Israeli settlers' communities to demand at least a termination for the site?
Well, it's quite true. The settlements, which is located in the Negev Desert near to the reactor, had suffered as well, like the Bedouin communities, the Palestinian Bedouin communities in that area, from the cancer. And it's true that some of these Israeli settlers cases against the reactor and its administration. But to what extent that would help or create a kind of an awareness inside Israel against the reactor to stop it and to shut it down, I doubt it, because north in Israel and the center of Israel in general, where is the most of the population there, they don't see that there is a big problem for them regarding the reactor. So I don't think that will make any kind of move. However, in the last few years, 2 or 3 years ago, there was a kind of a movement and a campaign. And particularly, it was driven by the Palestinian Arabs living inside Israel against the reactor, and to force Israel to go through the IAEA and to have their reactor inspected and to apply all the rules which is applied all over the world regarding the nuclear facilities all over the world. But the Israeli, I don't think that there will be a big campaign against the reactor, because within the Israeli mentality, they think that this is something for their own security in the region, and having a nuclear weapon in Israel is definitely for the benefit of the public in Israel. That's what they think. So I doubt that they are going to have a kind of a campaign. What? Unless the rate of infected people becomes
increases.
Really,
but the issue here is that if the internal occupied territories won't revolt against this, wouldn't this mean that at least the IAEA should oblige the Israelis to allow members of the agency to at least investigate the reactor? Can they do that?
Well, recently the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinians signed the agreements regarding the IAEA, though we have nothing to do with it, but, you know, to prevent such a thing to happen. So I think now it's about time that we should create a huge campaign internationally to force Israel to have the IAEA to inspect the reactor and to allow international experts to come to Israel and to Dimona reactor to inspect it and to put things within the right perspectives. But I don't think that Israeli would allow such a thing, because already Israel refused so far all the calls to have their reactor inspected, and also they refused to join and to sign the treaty with the IAEA, and they refuse totally to have them inspect. So we need a huge campaign, not only locally from the Palestinians and from the Palestinians inside Israel, but also from the international community in general, to force Israel to accept the terms of the inspections.
Well, that raises a lot of questions concerning the visits and the inspections that happened in Iraq prior to the U.S. invasion, and now the wailing, the international wailing, the hypocrisy and the criticism against the Islamic Republic of Iran for simply deciding to stop the visits, not deciding to stop people from coming in the first place. They now decided to stop the visits of the IAEA until all sanctions are lifted. Do you think such a case, with the Dimona being brought up front in the region of West Asia, do you think this will affect the upcoming JCPOA agreement or negotiation in any way?
I should think so, yeah, because by the end of the day, it's quite obvious to everyone that the Western world generally, led by the United States and even with the Europeans, they are a huge hypocrisy in this respect. When they know that the Israelis do have a reactor and they do oppose a nuclear weapon, and they have bombs, nuclear bombs in Israel, but yet no one is talking about it. While when the Iranian tried to have a nuclear reactor for peaceful means, the Israeli as well as the Western world became really so mad about it, and they want to put all these kind of inspections and the visits to the sites and everywhere, but they don't talk at all about Israel. And I believe that now in the reopening of the negotiation back again for America to join back the agreement with the Iranian regarding the nuclear reactor in Iran, that the Iranian also should mention and should put this kind of a condition, that if you want to inspect us and you want to put some limits, then you have to do the same with Israel, especially that the one who's leading the campaign against Iranian nuclear reactor is the Israeli, and always Netanyahu.
It's Benjamin Netanyahu himself doing a propaganda show in front of a big screen with the Iranian flag on it. We all watched it. We all laughed at the hypocrisy. But I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nimr Saad, academic at Birzeit University, for talking to us and telling us about the atrocities of the Dimona reactor inside Palestinian occupied territories. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
In the limelight.
Spain's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said around 23,000 migrants arrived in Canary Islands from Africa in 2020, more than seven times the number of arrivals in 2019. And Canary Islands government data shows almost 2,600 of them were unaccompanied minors, more than three times 2019's numbers. Here we present you an article in this regard written by Christopher Johnson under the heading, "More Child Migrants Are Arriving Alone in Spain's Holiday Islands Than Ever Before." The article was taken from ABC News website. Please stay tuned. Elementary school children don't typically venture far from home on their own, but 11-year-old Abu managed to cross a stretch of the Atlantic Ocean from Africa to Europe in the hands of strangers. Abu, from West Africa's Ivory Coast, boarded an inflatable dinghy along four other children and a mother and her baby, all bound for the Canary Islands in search of a better life. They arrived on the island of Fuerteventura in June 2020 after a full day's journey from southern Morocco. 4 years, migrants and refugees